Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 247 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Max Eilenberg speaks with John Siddique about the importance of love in children's fiction, his previous career in publishing, retelling a traditional fairy tale, and his enduring enthusiasm for the work of Bob Dylan.
Hello, I'm John Siddique. I've come down to London to meet with children's writer, publisher, pub band guitar player and magistrate, Max Eilenberg. Max's books for children are delightful, filled with what is the most essential ingredient of all, love. I find myself very keen to chat with Max about how we as men can express love much more in our lives and in our work. But we begin by talking about the books that he himself grew up with and the qualities that made them so important to him even to this day.
Hi Max, it's lovely to meet you.
And you, John.
I just wanted to start by asking you about your children's writing. I was just wondering, when you were a child, what books you loved. Could you tell us about some of the books that you loved and what got you
Yes,
moving?
Well, when I was a child, I liked Winnie the Pooh, of course. God bless Winnie the Pooh. I liked Toad of Toad Hall, The Wind in the Willows.
Yeah, The Wind in the Willows, yeah.
I still find myself going, The Open Road, whoop, whoop. The only other children's book I can remember that seemed to have children in it was Emil and the Detectives. That was just a fantastic story of kids taking over and running their own adventure. I never read Swallows and Amazons. I actually, at that age, didn't even read the Peter Rabbit books. There wasn't a lot of children's literature in
that. So what were you reading then when you were young?
When I was very, very young, I guess I was probably reading the Ladybird books. Are they called Janet and John? And
yeah, I think so. Like that. Yeah.
It's odd that that should be the case, but my father had no background in children's literature. He was a German-Jewish refugee. My mother, it's true, was a primary school teacher, but I don't have a memory of her reading to me, oddly enough, and I don't have any memory of children's books other than those sort of Edwardian or late Victorian favourites being around the house. I guess at a later stage I would have come across Robert Louis Stevenson or Peter Pan, some stage I would have come across them, but there weren't any of the sorts of children's books that I would have read to my children when they were growing up around the place. But still, very, very influential. I loved Winnie the Pooh.
And what was it? What was it about that you loved about Winnie the Pooh? Was it some kind of quality?
The relationship between a little boy and Pooh, between Christopher Robin. I found that very affecting. And Eeyore and Piglet. They were characters who were of a type. Eeyore-ish type characters.
Well, they're kind of emotional archetypes, aren't they, I suppose?
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I don't know if they are emotional archetypes, but they're very, very,
very
simple
clear,
very clear in that way. And so it gave you a grip on the world. They were terribly, you know, to use a word that I distrust in some way, but they were terribly empowering as characters if you identified with them. And I think I did with all of them, actually. Mm-hmm. They were each of them an aspect of myself as
Absolutely.
A child.
Yeah. Do you think, because I think that comes through in your books, I think that kind of demonstration of emotions and being able to relate to the different characters comes through in all of your children's books that I've read. One thing that I really did notice that was kind of the strongest thing that came through is that I could actually feel a lot of love in your books. Love was a very, very clear thing. Mm. And what was different about reading your books was that it had a kind of masculine element to it. You know, like in Cowboy Kid, it's the father kissing his son goodnight. And And the, and he kind of, you know, the boy kind of carries on playing through the night, and he kind of, the dad keeps coming back in. But the amount of love in the book, to be honest with you, you know, my wife and I, we still treat each other like kids sometimes. So we read them out loud to each other in bed, your books.
Oh.
and it was the love, we just enjoyed them so much. And but it was this masculine aspect of love that came through. So could you talk to us a little bit about that? Is that a deliberate thing?
I can't say.
I mean, did you go? Were you going for that quality when you?
I was going for love. It might be a truism. I don't know. To me, the emotional gravity, the emotional honesty of a book is key in a children's picture book. I think you have to be true, and particularly in that first book, in Cowboy Kid, that had to do with my strong sense of love to the little animals. I mean, the story is of a child who loves them all, his toys in bed every night. He wants to let them know that he loves them all, but he's faced with this absolute dilemma. He knows that if he kisses one first, that one might be seen by the others as being the favourite, and the one that gets kissed last will be seen by the others being, or might feel that he's been less loved. Kind of nightmare, and it's, well, nights and nights. I could not go to sleep as a child with precisely this dilemma. So in that story, there is a very central question of how to tell people that you have an unquantifiable amount of love in the face of their possibly not feeling that you love them enough.
Yeah, and what I loved about that book is, because you have this kind of relationship between the child and his toys, but then you have this enveloping love of the father,
yeah,
holding it all together.
Yes. You talked about masculine love. That's grown up me,
yeah,
obviously. And I'm a father now, and I want to tell my own children, I want to tell as well my friends, but I want anybody I love, I want to tell them I love them. So it was important to me in that book that the father should come into the room.
It's just something that we don't see enough of from men at all, the demonstration of love. Men are very loving beings.
Mm-hmm.
My experience of being a man and of being around other men is there's a huge amount of love.
Yes.
And it is expressed in a way that society doesn't seem to recognise, or it's kind of coded, or we don't see much of it reported in the media or anything like that.
No.
We tend to be kind of almost like caricatured,
yes,
I think, sometimes. And it was just so refreshing, I think, for me, because all four of the books I looked at have this loving quality to them. So I was thinking, you know, asking you as a kind of writer of deep loving children's books, how do you think we can kind of bring more of a balance out? How can we bring more love out?
In the world.
In the world, yeah. And into literature and into our arts and, you know, into our expressions of life. Because you've done it so beautifully.
Oh, well, thank you. I think, well, you're right. We live under the weight of, you know, thousands of years of patriarchy, and it's not going away anytime soon. So there's no simple solution to it. We can try and do it, I think, in our personal lives. We can be better people. We can be better men. We can be better men to each other. I have friends who clearly love each other. They can't do anything except play golf together.
Yeah.
That's their expression.
Yeah.
You know, we make this, there's a common distinction, isn't there, between the talk that women can have and, well, men do activities together. And I think we need to find a language. And it's a language as well of touch and,
yeah,
of hug,
yeah,
and of wordlessness. And I think that we need to start it at a very young age. And I think that we need to have children's books that help their readers, and by their readers I mean both the children and the parents who read to them, understand the importance of the emotion of love as an express presence in the world, not as implied, but expressed, and therefore the importance of expressing it. So I know, for instance, that a book like Guess How Much I Love You has as its central loving character a hare. I don't know what gender that hare is, if any gender. It's just a hare. And it's just about love. So more books like that from an early age that make everybody happy because they allow them to talk about love.
Yeah, I think so. And do you think publishers, because you work in publishing as well.
Yes, I do.
Do you think that publishing is open to this or not open to this?
Well,
because it's the gatekeeper. It's the gatekeeping that often kind of stands in the way of things changing.
I absolutely accept that. We have our views about where children's publishing sits within the scope of publishing and how it's regarded. But I think there's a lot of money to be made out of publishing for children and publishing well. Not least because so many people have children and so many people want to buy books for parents to read to children. So it can be a very, very profitable sector.
Mm. So you don't work in publishing anymore, but you were in publishing for a long while.
I was in publishing for about 10 or 15 years.
And what did you do within publishing?
Well, I had a variety of jobs. They were all editorial. I ended up running something called an imprint called Secker and Warburg.
Oh, my gosh.
I was the publisher of that. And it was, for me, the ideal job. If I could invent one, that would be it. And we had a paperback arm as well, called Minerva. So I was publisher of both of those. And I worked in various other companies before. But there came a moment at which the division of which Secker & Warburg was part was being sold to Random House, I'm so sorry. And the division of responsibilities in the way Random House was structured was different. And I knew that, you know, I might remain publisher of Secker, but I wouldn't enjoy the same deep responsibility that I did before. So I abandoned that.
Mm.
But yes, I was in it. So I understand very well, I think, how the business works. And I had the enormous privilege of working with some wonderful, wonderful writers.
Yeah.
So some terrific times.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. It must used to be so interesting to kind of see both sides of things. You know, you've got the writer's perspective and the publisher's perspective as well.
Yeah. The best is when everything's in harmony.
Yeah.
The worst is when you know that the particular text for which you feel such enthusiasm is going to meet a kind of institutional indifference further on down the line. And that for all your fine words at a sales conference or for all your attempts to get hold of some marketing budget or publicity, it's just going to be, unless somebody shares your passion, an uphill struggle. But equally, there are so many times as a publisher when you know that the moment of acquisition of the book is the moment of maximum enthusiasm, and after that it's downhill all the way. And I'll never forget, in my life at Methian, I published Steve Bell, the wonderful cartoonist, political satirist, and we had a launch for one of his collections of IF cartoons, I think it was, or maybe it was another, and he gave a brief speech at the launch party. He said, "Welcome to the remainder party." And that was, yes, he understands it. Hopefully it wasn't a direct remainder. In fact, it was a great success.
Yeah.
But yes, you do see it from both sides.
Yeah, yeah. Just going back to your children's books for just a couple of minutes, how did you move into children's writing? You were telling...
Oh, well, I moved into children's writing because the illustrator of Cowboy Kid, Sue Heap, is a close personal friend, and my partner Caroline knows Sue independently, and Sue had written this book Cowboy Baby, which had gone on to win the Smarties Prize. It's a beautiful book, and she said that Walker Books, the publisher, would like another book for Sue to do, but she didn't have a story. And she, Caroline, thought that a story that I used to tell, well, the story I used to tell her about my difficulties as a child with my toys, would be a good story for Sue. And I thought, oh, well, I'll try writing that down. And she couldn't, of course, be the editor or anything for that book. It would have been quite improper. But she took the draft of it to a man who was then the chairman of Walker Books, an amazing character, a great man, and a dear friend called David Lloyd. And he agreed to take it on, and he was my editor for everything afterwards.
Wow.
And he liked the fact that it began with love, that it was a sort of direct
thing. Yeah, like I say, such a strong thing.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, your USP, as it were,
yeah,
is love.
Love, love. But so there you are, there's a kind of element, of, you might say, of nepotism.
Yeah.
That says my partner works in publishing, and children's publishing, and indeed her mother worked in children's publishing.
He married well.
Yes.
Yeah. You've also done retellings of Cinderella.
Yeah.
And Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And I found those two very interesting, because your retellings bring some quite different elements in.
Uh-huh.
With the Cinderella story. You know, I only seem to remember one party, but you have several parties, and they keep kind of coming faster and faster. I found that very, very funny.
Okay.
But I was wondering whether you were going to go right back to kind of the classic story with the sisters cutting their toes off and things, but you didn't go there.
Well, it was a temptation.
Was it? I mean,
yes, because, you know, you remind me now, of course, I must have read, or been read to, the Grimm fairy tales and
the pre-Grimm versions.
Yes. Yeah. And what I did was, for that book, actually, I went to the library and got out all the versions I could find. I got out things like, what's he called, Vladimir Prop on the Seven Types of Story, and blah, 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 blah. Yes, and there are versions involving cows, and there are versions in just everything. This was a case of where David, my friend at Walker Books, had said, we have to get a writer for an illustrator who wants to do Cinderella. Could you do? And I looked at her style, and you don't want any toes coming off in her pictures, I think. So we tried to make it, I did have a lot of activity going on. And in fact, it seemed that the way she drew, you could have more fun with words and kasplat and wow, boom. Sounds,
yeah,
a sort of animate. It's not an animated book. The more animation in the text, in terms of action and play with language, would work well with her fabulous pictures.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it's a very simple story.
It is,
isn't it?
Is.
Ultimately,
yeah. Just to kind of round out, reading your biography, you know, there's your love of Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah.
And just as a kind of little challenge for you, as somebody who has absolutely no love of Bob Dylan whatsoever.
No! Heidi, get me out!
I just thought maybe...
Sorry, can I just interrupt you?
Yeah.
Is that you've got no love of Bob Dylan because you just haven't found Bob Dylan yet? Or you have no...
I have tried.
Oh, my God.
And I have had... I won't name any names. A friend of mine who's on the radio has sent me things, pushed at me, prodded me. You've got to like Bob Dylan. I'm trying. Right? Yeah. And nothing resonates. So tell us about your love for Bob Dylan.
Where to begin? It probably begins in Dartmouth in about, I'm not sure what the year it would have been, 1966. I was visiting, my aunt used to run a pub called the Dartmouth Arms, and she had a son who was a few years older than me, and he always had the records. I was too young really to be buying them. Well, 13 or so. And positively 4th Street. Wow! Just everything changed. And, you know, everything had already changed. We'd already had the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, for goodness sake. But this was something completely other, and it's just one of the great songs, and it was a great song driven not just by the music, which was fantastic, and not only by the snarl, but by the lyrics. And yeah, I've got books and books of Bob Dylan lyrics, and I love his music. He tells fabulous stories, some of them involving archetypes, some of them involving absolutely mysterious legends. You know, I play in a band. I'm always trying to get them to sing Bob Dylan songs. Quite sensibly, they refused. But yeah, Bob Dylan is just the greatest, and he's got the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes.
So there
you go. You see, that's the answer to me.
Call yourself a poet.
Well, yeah, get with Bob Dylan. There you go. I know plenty of people of this opinion of Bob Dylan. It's just that it's never. The only thing I brought could get it down to is that it must have been of its time, perhaps, and there are things that happen that if you come a little bit later, that maybe they don't kind of have the same resonance for you. Yeah. You know, I don't get the Beatles either, for example.
No.
I'm just a little bit maybe in the wrong time. And yet you feel like you're missing out on something, and yet it just can't, it just doesn't communicate. Its language doesn't kind of quite come across in a way. So I just wondered if literature was like this too, you know, if Joyce was around today, would he stand a chance? If Bob Dylan was around today, would he stand a chance?
Yeah.
Could you imagine, I don't know, you know, James Joyce having to go down the spoken word contest or something, you know?
No, I can't imagine that. No, I think he'd hightail it out of there.
Yeah.
Fashions come and go, don't they? Yeah. I mean, it's cracky. There's an absolute slew of highly respected late Victorian novels, which it is unimaginable that anybody could ever have written, let alone voluntarily read. So, yeah, perfectly possible that the Joyces and the rest of them will be overlooked in time. But I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Things seem to find a way through, don't they? You know, like love finds its way.
They do. True things. Increasingly, I think, true and simple things. Not to say that the truth is simple. Oh, Lord, what can I... Words, stories, texts, music, paintings, objects, gardens... Things that speak to you in a direct way about an important, not even important, just about a truth. Those are the things that find a way through. You can marvel at the rest. You can marvel at the cleverness of... Well, I do marvel at John Donne, but I find myself reading George Herbert. Oddly. Just clear.
Thank you, Max. We'll stop there. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, John.
That was Max Eilenberg in conversation with John Siddiq. You can find out more about Max on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 247, which was recorded by John Siddiq and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 248, Anne Morgan talks to Carolyn Sanderson about her Reading the World project and books that cross borders, the role of nature and nurture in shaping identity, and the benefits of the pram in the hall. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.